seeing is believing. Remember when that was a true statement? Now, with the aid of computer animation, morphing, digital images, digital sound, and all kinds of computer manipulation, you can be watching a movie on the big screen and have no idea what's real and what's not. The idea that seeing is believing is simply no longer true. One movie that comes to mind is the 1994 Oscar-winning film Forrest Gump. It won for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Visual Effects. You might remember how one of the main characters, played by Gary Sinise, lost his legs in the Vietnam War. And even though we knew that Gary Sinise really had legs, he was shown in scene after scene legless. State-of-the-art visual imaging had removed them. So yes, it's getting harder and harder to know what we can believe in today's world of cyberspace and almost magical technology. And if it's true that what's real and what isn't real, what's true and what isn't true, what can and can't be believed, all have become indistinguishable, then how do you get your prospects to believe you? Before we answer that, stop and think for a minute, who is it that you believe? There's probably someone you can think of that you'd believe just about anything they told you. Someone in your life that you respect so much, trust so much, and believe so much, that if they told you, I was abducted by aliens, flown in their spacecraft to a distant planet, and returned to Earth safely, you'd believe it. Now that's a real stretch, but you get the point. If they have credibility and believability, you might even believe that abduction story. Now go the other way. Think of someone you know who, no matter what they tell you, it's suspect. You have a hard time believing almost anything they tell you. Who comes to mind on this one? Well, if you're like most people, your list of those you believe and totally trust is much shorter than those you don't believe. It's unfortunate that there's so much cynicism about things. But hey, we've all been around the block before. We've experienced disappointment and disillusionment with our heroes and role models. Our leaders have often lacked credibility. And even the little things like broken promises we hear almost daily can make us more cynical. You've heard them. Things like, in a retail store, oh, I'll be with you in a minute. Yeah, a half hour later, you're still there waiting for help. An associate at work says, okay, just give me a second, I'm almost done. Yeah, right. A dentist about to drill, oh, this won't hurt much. Ow! A financial services salesperson says, you know, you're going to make a killing on this investment. Right, you'll just kill my money. Or the past due customer says, gee, the check is in the mail, didn't you get it yet? It just gets harder and harder to believe these and the dozens of other things people tell us each day. Should I believe you if you came to sell me your product? Well, let's discuss this vital and often overlooked aspect of selling, achieving believability and trust with your customers. Because it's not what you say, it's whether the customer believes and perceives what you say to be true. You know, a survey of trust and believability was conducted by USA Today, CNN, and the Gallup poll organizations. The poll measured how people rated different professions in terms of believability. Here's the percentage they gave to each group. Now, before you hear these ratings, if your profession scores low, remember, it's not you. It's those ordinary salespeople. These are the groups that rated the highest, and let me read you the list. Druggists and pharmacists, 65%. They scored number one. Clergy came in at 53%. College teachers, 52%. Medical doctors, 51%. Dentists, 50%. Policemen, 50%. Only those six professions scored over 50%. Now let's go to the middle group, scoring in the 20% to 49% range of believability rating. Engineers, 49%. Funeral directors, 34%. TV reporters and commentators, 28%. Bankers, 28% also. Journalists, 26%. Newspaper reporters, 22%. Business executives and building contractors both came in at 20%. That's the middle eight. Now for those under 20%. Now that's pretty low scoring for these 12 professions. Local politicians, 19%. Senators, 18%. Lawyers, 16%. Right along with talk show hosts. Real estate agents came in at 15%. Three were in the 14% range. congressmen, labor union leaders, state office holders. 13% for stockbrokers. Insurance people came in at 10%. Advertising people, 8%. And car salespeople, 6%. Would you agree with these findings? I mean, some groups sure didn't score very well. Lots of books by comedy writers have been published filled with political humor, lawyer jokes, used car sales jokes. Just say the term used car salesman, and the images of some loud, pushy guy dressed in plaid polyester pants and smoking a big cigar, greeting you with, "Hey, buddy, have I got a deal for you today?" Well, maybe that's a bit exaggerated, but you've got to agree that that caricature had to come from somewhere. So no matter where your group comes in, to help improve your ratings with your prospect, here are some specific suggestions. And again, think of someone you believe in and trust. Anyone you work with or do business with. Why do you trust and believe in them? Isn't it because during your relationship with that person, they have proven by their actions that they do what they say they will do? Their performance verifies their words. Don't tell anyone this, and they don't. I'll have it for you Thursday at 3 p.m. And they do. You know, I dropped the ball and I'm sorry. They admit mistakes. Hey, you know, I really need your help on this. Will you help me? They tell it like it is. What about those who don't know you yet? They have very little to judge you by on a performance basis except what they have heard about you from others. Therefore, your reputation precedes you. Or how you come across when you're with them. And how do salespeople come across to prospects? The ordinary ones, the typical salespeople, make wild claims, sound overly confident, don't listen, just talk, and talk some more. Don't follow through or follow up. And they get caught in an untruth. Why do you think politicians scored only 14%? And that includes Congress. Just look at our presidents over the last few decades. April 30th, 1973, President Nixon makes this statement to the American public. "I did not cover up Watergate." And then on August 9, 1974, he resigns as president because of his part in the cover-up. Well, how about President Clinton's nationally televised statement to the American public? "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky." Or his debate with the grand jury over the definition of the word "is." And it's not just politicians. Business people do it in little ways almost every day. A boss says to his secretary, "Just tell her I'm not in." Lies, lies, lies. So suggestion number one, to achieve the trust and believability of your prospects, tell the truth. And if you don't know the truth, just say, "You know, I don't know, but I'll find out. You know, I think I know, but better let me check it out first so I'm sure I'm right. Let me do my homework and I'll get back to you on this. Or I'm going to call my sales manager. She knows everything." Is it possible to tell the truth and still make the sale? Of course it is. The fact that salespeople have lied to you and me in the past doesn't mean that every salesperson lies. Same about politicians, too. Not all are liars. George Bernard Shaw said after almost 90 years of living on the earth, quote, "The liar's punishment is not in the least that he's not believed, but that he cannot believe anyone else." Oh, how true that is. Liars themselves seem to be the most skeptical. A salesman who was notorious for lying died. As his customers passed by his open casket, one of them said to another, "I still don't believe him." He was the kind of person you wouldn't believe even if he swore he was lying. I mean, you could always tell when he was lying. His lips were moving. Okay, those weren't too funny. And as we said before, lying to prospects isn't funny either. In recent years, salespeople have faced litigation for misrepresenting or concealing the truth about their products from their customers. Have you had some experiences where salespeople have gone out of their way to tell you the truth? Like a waiter who says as you order dinner, "Gee, you know, I wouldn't recommend the prime rib tonight. It's just not up to our usual standards. It's a bit tough." Now that's truthful selling, especially when they make another suggestion and you're thrilled with your dinner. Or the Mercedes-Benz salesperson who told our friend, "You know, I just don't think you're going to be happy with that smaller model." But our friend said she wanted it anyway. You know, sometimes customers feel they know better. So she bought the smaller model, and as she took delivery, the salesperson said, "Now, if for any reason you aren't satisfied, we can exchange it for the larger one, no problem." Well, she drove it for 2 days and hated it. Went back and got the bigger one. Now, that's telling the truth and backing it up. And almost two decades later, she's still driving a big, full-size Mercedes. It's her third one. There's an old adage that if you get caught in just one lie, almost everything is suspect. So work on not only being truthful, but proving you're truthful. Let's say that there have been some products your company sold that were bombs, or maybe not total dogs, just not very good, and your customers bought them or heard about them. Just tell the truth. Mr. Director of Quality Control, this new system that you've been evaluating is far superior to the original model we came out with 4 years ago. Not only did that original model have so many service problems, it flat out just didn't do the job. We took it off the market as soon as those problems began showing up and didn't re-enter the marketplace until now with this vastly improved model. It's been thoroughly tested for 2 years. Here, look at how you can, and now build a unit of conviction. That's being truthful. Suggestion number two, avoid exaggeration. I mean, you know the type of exaggeration people use. Hey, buddy, I caught 1,000 fish bigger than that one. Made a cool $1 million on a deal. Took me a quick hour to put it all together. Everyone's calling me to run for office. I'd win by a landslide. Hey, I shot 70 today and had 10 drives, well over 300 yards. No, no, no. Don't exaggerate. Be unique. Understate. Do what Willie Cooley taught us. Promise a lot. Deliver even more. Choose your words carefully. Remember we talked earlier about avoiding always, never, everyone? Watch out for it. We always deliver on time. We never have a customer complaint. Everyone just loves us. Instead, use often, sometimes, rarely, and most people. Here, let me restate those examples in words that build believability. We usually deliver on time. Matter of fact, here's our official delivery results for the first quarter. 96.3% on time. You know, we rarely get a customer complaint, and when we do, our service team gets on it within 24 hours. Here, look how we do that. Well, most people just love it. Last year, our customer service index was 97.9%. Now, here's a fun exercise for you. For the next week, keep a list of the exaggerations you hear other salespeople use. The reason I call it a fun exercise is that exaggeration is one of the fundamental principles of comedy. Great comedians use exaggeration to get laughs. And unfortunately, salespeople who use exaggeration usually get laughs too, but mostly behind their backs. Let me prove it to you with this line that a fishing friend of mine uses. His name is Jerry Puckett from Page, Arizona. And he's a successful businessman, tournament bass fishing pro, professional fishing guide, and almost a full-time comedian. He used to do a show on the radio every morning, and Jerry was the master of exaggeration, calling Lake Powell, where he was based, the Big Pond. Now, Lake Powell is 181 miles long, 500 feet deep in many places, and has 1,960 miles of shoreline. A big pond? You bet. Well, it's fine to exaggerate in fun, and to exaggerate in fun while fishing with Jerry Puckett, or while you're with your friends and family. But it's not such a good idea to exaggerate with your customers. So keep a list for a week, and then make sure you avoid those expressions in your selling presentations. Remember at the very beginning of this series when I introduced two of the main principles of the program? Find out what everybody else is doing, and then don't do it. And TLC, think like a customer. Here's how it applies to exaggeration. Do the opposite. Understate. Reduce the benefit. Make it so believable to your customer. Let's say you can offer proven, documentable, tangible, and predictable results for your clients. In other words, your product can and does this, this, and this, and in these quantities. Then take it all away, or cut it in half, or by a third, some dramatic amount. That's what Jerry Puckett did years ago when I hired him to teach me to bass fish at Lake Powell, the Big Pond. I had been fishing for years since I was a little kid, but not at Lake Powell. And it's a tough lake for an amateur. So I called Jerry to check on his fee for a full-day guide trip and book a date for the next week. Oh, you would have loved his sales presentation. Sure, he had one. He was in the club, the top 1% club. He qualified me first. How did I get his name? How good a fisherman was I? What did I know about Lake Powell? And he asked me a lot of other stuff. Then he began his fish selling. It was a great time to be going. The fishing was excellent. And then he reviewed his past few guide trips and told me how many fish they had caught. Very impressive. And then he did something you don't hear very often from salespeople. He understated. He said, "Joel, just supposing when we go fishing next week, you catch only half as many as the people who went out last week. How would you feel?" "Well, gee," I said, "it still sounds terrific." "Well, what if you only caught a few fish?" "Hey, fishing is fishing," I said. "That would still be fine." Then he said, "What if, after all day of fishing, you didn't catch a single fish, but you learned how to fish in difficult conditions, how to work different types of bait that you now don't use, and most importantly, where the fish usually are at the different seasons? How would you feel at the end of the day if it was a strictly education and theory day?" "Jerry," I said, "you know, that sounds even better. And if we caught anything, it would just be a bonus." Now that's how to sell. So when your customer gets the product, they're thrilled. Think about it. How could Jerry Puckett possibly have control over the fish? A cold front could come through and wreak havoc with their feeding habits. The wind could come up. I mean, there are so many variables beyond his control. So he just controlled the controllables, the education and the fun. Jerry knew we would catch something, but he understated. He got the commitment from me that my investment would be worth it just for the education. In this case, he delivered both, because when we went bass fishing that next week, I caught more fish in that one day with Jerry than I had all year on my own. The end result, I was thrilled. And of course, I hired him several times again. Repeat business comes when your customer is thrilled. So if you can deliver 1,000 units of satisfaction, no doubt in your mind, say to your prospect something like this: "This XL37B unit has a proven track record of 1,000 units per hour. But your situation is very unique. Let's say it only puts out 900. Would you still feel good about your investment?" "Oh, sure," the prospect says. "Hey, right now we're only putting out 480, 490 an hour." "So how about 500? Could you live with 500 an hour, knowing that the new unit won't have anywhere near the maintenance cost or the downtime that your present unit has?" "Well, yes, I guess I could live with 500. Now you're in a position to thrill your customer. You know you can get 1,000, maybe even more. But what would happen if you promised 1,000 and get 999? The result is disappointment. But promise 500 and get 999, and your customer is thrilled beyond all expectations. The key is to understate, not exaggerate. Next suggestion, number 3, use specific numbers. When you round off numbers, it sounds like a claim. This is so common among ordinary salespeople. If there are 100 numbers between 1 and 100, does it make statistical sense that a survey would result in numbers like 50% do, 30% don't, and 20% are unsure? I mean, no way. So be specific. And if you have to round off, say you're rounding off. "You know, Mr. Gallinson, that situation you described probably happens about half the time. I mean, I'm guessing here, but it's about 50-50. See, that's being honest, explaining that it's a guess and not exaggerating. Could research show it's 50%, exactly 50%? Most likely not. Okay, here's another illustration I use in my live seminars on how to sell value, not price. In this example, I'm going to state the problem, price buyers. I'm going to use exaggeration and humor to describe how cheap some prospects can be. I'll use some rounded off numbers in the form of percentages and then tell a story that will get audience involvement, use specific numbers, no untruths, and no exaggeration." Okay, now as you listen, put yourself in the audience, surrounded by your sales associates who sell what you sell, okay? Let's discuss the principle of selling called value versus price. We used earlier the balance scale concept of two bowls on a balance bar, one marked price and the other marked value. And we also talked about buying some jelly beans for $5 a pound. And when you heard that, you might have thought, "Wow, where does he find jelly beans for only $5 a pound? If you've bought any lately, you know they cost a lot more than that." But there are some prospects who might be even too cheap to pay $5 a pound. They say things like, "Hey, I can get those cheaper at the discount store." Or they might say, "Why bother with jelly beans at all? We can find some cheaper kind of candy. Hey, maybe we could just go to the ballroom of one of those hotels where companies hold their national sales meetings and offer the room set of people 50 cents a pound for their leftover candy. That's really cheap. You know, there certainly are price-only buyers. You know the kind, so cheap they get upset if they get better before their medicine is all used. So cheap their idea of being forced to commit an unnatural act is to pick up a dinner check. Okay, I'll stop. You get the point. Some buyers are just tight. They look for the lowest price, and that's how they buy just about everything. My suggestion is don't waste time with them. They usually make up less than 10% of your prospect base. Then there's maybe another 10% that are totally unconcerned about price at all. They want something, they get it, no matter what the price is. So that leaves approximately 80% of all prospects somewhere in between. Now in your market, it might be 15%, 15%, and 70%, or 25%, 25%, and 50%. Yet most prospects will invest in the product and pay the price if they see the value. But think about what your customer really gets when they buy low price. And this is true for almost any product. Here, I made a list of what they get. Worry, aggravation, frustration and inconvenience, delays, wasted time, product uncertainty, and recurring problems. Poor service, slow service, or even no service at all. Poor hands-on training or instruction. The risk of the company going out of business. We could go on, but you get the point. So now make your own specific list of what your customers and prospects can expect from the cheapest, lowest price, and the price-selling competition. There are a number of pitfalls of just selling low price, because many times your customer starts to think, could I have gotten you down even lower? Are you selling to someone else for less? Maybe I can get it cheaper somewhere else. Where are you cutting corners and reducing quality? So selling low price is really not the answer. Now, using the balance scale concept, let's go to the value side. What can your customers expect from your company and your product sold with the high-value approach? Let me read you this list. Time, effort, and energy saved. Peace of mind. Problems solved quickly. Accurate information, fast. Product confidence. Exceptional service, and fast. Knowledgeable staff. Dependable delivery. Dealing with people who care and are concerned. Company stability. You'll be around. 100% honest and ethical treatment. Complete and accurate information, special guarantees and warranties, doing the little extras, a total commitment from sales, support, and service people within your organization. Now make your own specific value list. What do your prospects get when they invest and become your customers? Of course, the one thing no competitor can give them is you, and that's worth a lot. So what qualities that you possess can you add to the value side of your scale of decision? Well, make a list, and please don't be modest. What's your added value to the selling equation? Your caring and concern, your knowledge and your skills, your enthusiasm and joyfulness, your fast response, being timely, your accuracy, your sense of humor. Subtract the disappointments, they'll be spared. Divide the higher investment, the price, by the additional benefits that they will get, and then multiply the satisfaction of added value and quality they will have. So far, it sounds great in theory, right? But yes, there are negatives. Yes, there is a price. Yes, there are objections. But you don't have to eliminate or even overcome these. All you need to do is add enough positives. Positives in favor of value. Then make sure your prospects believe you and trust you. Remember, we covered three specific areas to focus on to achieve believability. Number one, tell the truth. Number two, avoid exaggeration. And number three, use specific numbers. And that's where this next story comes in. So now, let me prove it to you. It's just piling on value. Let's say I have a car to sell. And let's also say you're looking for a car to buy. Being a member of the top 1% club and using TLC, thinking like a customer, and being prepared, I think I know your first two questions. Number one, what kind of car is it that you're selling, Joel? And number two, how much does it cost? Wouldn't those be the prospect's first two questions? So let me answer them for you. Number one, it's a Ferrari, and it's used. Number two, the price is $1 million. Now I'm going to close. Would you like to pick it up today or tomorrow? And you say, the price is too high. I don't want to use Ferrari. And frankly, you're thinking, Joel, you're nuts. Absolutely nuts. Are we on track here? Good. Now, so far, all you know is the price and the product, and you know nothing of its value. But you also know what cars cost new and used. A car might be $50,000, and a luxury car might be $150,000 or more. A Ferrari, brand new, is at least $150,000, and the top-end production model of a Ferrari is over $250,000. These are round numbers, and of course they vary, dealer to dealer and year to year. Even if you don't know the cost of a new Ferrari, you know it's not $1 million. So now, let's get out that balance scale, and on the price side, put the $1 million. It's big, and it's heavy, sitting there, hanging high in the air, though, on the other side of the scale, is value. So let me tell you about your new car. Did you catch the U in there? It's a 1962 Ferrari, 250 GTO. It was sold at auction to Hans Thulin from Sweden on May 20th, 1990, for $10,830,000. Hans has some current income tax problems and needs to show a big loss and would be willing to take less than 10 cents on the dollar, just $1 million. An Arab sheikh from Kuwait wants that car and is willing to pay $10 million cash. Now, just supposing everything you just heard about this car is true and you could verify it all, would you be interested in it? Well, of course, a $9 million profit? Who wouldn't be? Now, what just happened? The price is still $1 million. All I did was add value. And that, my friend, is what your job is. To add so much value that the price isn't the deciding factor. Value is. Here are some words from the past that are still valid today, over a century later. Here, let me read you what John Ruskin wrote. It's unwise to pay too much, but it's unwise to pay too little. When you pay too much, you lose a little money. That is all. When you pay too little, you sometimes lose everything, because the thing you bought is incapable of doing the thing you bought it to do. The common law of business balance prohibits paying a little and getting a lot. It can't be done. If you deal with the lowest bidder, it's well to add something for the risk you run. And if you do that, you'll have enough to pay for something better. Oh, that's so good. And it was written by John Ruskin, who died in the year 1900. Okay, now, in listening to that story about the $1 million Ferrari, what did you learn? Hopefully you got an aha about the value-adding process. That was the principle, and your assignment is to come up with your own value-added lists. Now, that example also demonstrates the use of numbers and being specific. There were two types of numbers, round numbers, approximate numbers, and there's a place for them. Let's say when I told you about the cost of a new Ferrari and was specific with the model numbers and pricing. Could that change? Sure, it already has. When I saw a Ferrari on the road a while back, I was curious, and I called our local dealer to ask the price. He told me then his model 360M started at $148,000, and his 456M started at $232,000. So if you called your local Ferrari dealer and got a price today, they might say they don't even make the 360M and the 456M anymore. So rather than lock my example into a specific, I used round numbers, $150,000 to $250,000. You can do the exact same thing as long as you tell the customer you're doing it. Okay, now what about the specifics about Hans? Which sounds more credible? Well, there was this guy from somewhere in Europe, he paid, I don't know, $10 million for an old Ferrari. Or the one that I used with the specific numbers and dates and his name. So be specific and exact when it's important. Think back to the previous 11 messages you've listened to and the specifics I got into. I hope you felt they added credibility to the messages. Okay, now let's go on to suggestion number 4. Use specific statements. Avoid broad, sweeping generalities like, we're the best. Nobody can match our speed. It has unlimited memory. The capacity is endless. It'll never get outdated. Oh, you'll love it. You can trust us. We're totally honest. Hey, be specific like this. Last year, the local Better Business Bureau published the results of how many complaints they had received about air conditioning repair people and their companies. I'm proud to say that we had not a single complaint and have had a clean record for over 23 years that we've been in business. Now, that's a specific statement, as opposed to, you can trust us. Who makes these broad, sweeping generalities? The stereotypical salespeople from the days of Willie Loman and Arthur Miller's classic play. You're not from that school. You're a pro. So speak like one. Be specific. Now, those broad, sweeping generalities are fine if you can back them up and make them into units of conviction. How about, we're the best? Back it up. You know, Mr. Duhamel, I'm sure almost every salesperson who calls on you tells you their air conditioning system is the best. So here, look at the recent Consumer Report research study. Notice of the 16 systems tested, the one we're recommending for your needs is rated number one. That would give you confidence, wouldn't it? See, you get the point. Prove the generalization if you can, and if you can't, don't use it. Now, suggestion number five. Use impacting, image-creating analogies. So often, salespeople who live and breathe their products use numbers that are meaningless or not very impacting to their prospects. So to add to your believability, start relating the known to the unknown. For example, in my live seminars back in the 1990s, I would use an illustration about the national debt being approximately $5 trillion at that time. Now, it was a good way to relate the known to the unknown. Plus, it was a nice round number to work with. Here's the analogy. Do you know how much $5 trillion is? How about $1 trillion? A billion? A million? Well, we all know it's a lot, but exactly what would it look like? Then I have the audience make a fist. Now you make a fist. Okay, now you're looking at your fist. It's about 4 inches high. Big man larger, tiny woman smaller. I have fairly big hands, and my fist is about 4.5 inches high. Judy is tiny, and her fist is 3.25 inches high. Now picture a stack of $1,000 bills. They're not in circulation anymore now, but let's say we could get them, and you stack them up 4 inches high. You'd now have $1 million. That's a lot of money. Not much in height, but it's still $1 million. Now, how high is $1 billion? $1 billion is 333 feet high, a 33-story skyscraper of $1,000 bills. Wow! $1 million is 4 inches. $1 billion is 333 feet. So how much is $1 trillion? 62.5 miles high of $1,000 bills. And $5 trillion is 312.5 miles high. Aha! Does that create a picture in your mind? So what picture do you need your prospect to visualize so they can see the benefit of what your product does for them? Along with this example of image-creating analogies is the use of image-creating stories. By now, I'm sure you know how strongly I believe in stories to make a point and illustrate principles. And hopefully, you now believe in them too and are using them as well. Earlier on message number one, you met Mr. Willie Cooley, the cab driver from Memphis. Now on message 12, meet another professional named Marquita Andrews from New York City. The story of Marquita illustrates so many of the principles that we've been discussing in this program. Plus add some unique factors that we'll discuss after you hear it. Marquita was a top-producing sales professional. As a matter of fact, she set a record 1 year of 1,754 sales in a 24-day period. Her organization has branches all over the free world, and she was number one that year. As a result of her outstanding success, she was interviewed by a writer who asked Marquita, "What are the secrets behind your selling success?" Okay, let me read you what Marquita said, and as you listen, ask yourself, how can you apply these six principles in your selling situation? Number one, have a goal. When you set a goal, you have to stick to it. You shouldn't say, oh, I'm tired. I'm not going to do anymore. You have to keep at it. You know, she practiced what she preached because 2 years before she had set her record, she sold 648 units. Then the following year, 1,148. And for her record-breaking year, she sold 1,754 units. She didn't compete with others. She competed with herself. That's what true professionals do. Her long-range goal was to sell over 40,000 units in her career. Now, that's a big goal. But when you break it down into short-range goals, it's realistic. Okay, number two, she said, make good use of time. I go where the good customers are. When I approach a prospect, I use the words, hi, I'm a neighbor. You know, it works. They feel comfortable, and I do too. Since I work close to home, this makes it possible to see a lot of people every day. You see, her time was limited. She had responsibilities at home. Number three, make good use of backup services. My job is to sell, so I leave the paperwork and record keeping to someone else. You know, this might not be possible for you, but Marquita said she has a family member who keeps her records for her. Number four, have a good presentation. I like the direct approach, she says. I just show them my product, build participation with samples and visuals in my presentation book, and then ask for the order. Number five, you have to close, Marquita said. I ask people to invest. I'm not afraid, but I also am careful not to sell them too much. You see, I want their business again, and if I overload them, they won't come back for more. And finally, Marquita's sixth principle to selling success. You have to enjoy selling, she says. And I do. I like meeting people and telling them about my products. I'm not sure how long I'll stay with what I'm doing now, but I know I'll stay in sales. Now, that's pretty good advice, wouldn't you say? Again, let me review her 6 points. Have a goal. Make good use of your time. Make good use of your support services. Have a good presentation. You have to close. And you have to enjoy selling. Not necessarily anything new, but it proves that great truths don't have to be complicated. In fact, these probably sound almost childlike in their simplicity. Well, you might be surprised to learn that Marquita Andrews was only 8 years old when she was interviewed, and these are her 6 secrets to selling Girl Scout cookies. Her goal was to beat her previous record. She had to be well organized since she was in school all day. She noticed that lobbies of apartment houses were much more productive than laundry rooms. She said, you know, in laundry rooms, people will listen to you because they have nothing else to do. But the lobbies have a lot more people, and I go where the people are. In her presentation, Marquita would provide a free sample if a prospect needed to see more value to reach the will invest line. Her closing question was usually, how many boxes of each do you want? A choice close with positive expectancy. Well, this amazing little girl didn't stop selling Girl Scout cookies. Once she outgrew the brownies, she kept at it. When she became a Girl Scout, she even had a Walt Disney movie made about her called The Cookie Girl. And she spoke at a number of national sales conferences for groups like IBM and the insurance industry's $1 Million Roundtable. Then at the mature age of 13, with 7 solid years of experience behind her, she set a new goal. In the Girl Scout magazine, she read about a contest. The Girl Scout who sold the most cookies would win an all-expense-paid trip for two around the world. And in just 3 weeks' time, this selling superstar, a top 1% club member, sold 3,526 boxes of cookies and won that trip around the world for herself and her mother. When Marquita's Girl Scout cookie selling career finally ended, her total sales exceeded 42,000 boxes of cookies. That's being the Michael Jordan of basketball, the Tiger Woods of golf, the Wayne Gretzky of ice hockey, the Mark McGuire of baseball, the Williams sisters of tennis, all rolled into one young girl. She even wrote a book in 1986, How to Sell More Cookies, Condos, Cadillacs, and Everything Else, with the help of her professional writer, Cheryl Mercer, published by Random House. And the last we heard of Marquita, she was heading off to Princeton University. I wonder what she's selling today. One thing is for sure, she was a sales pro who knew what it meant to sell it with the $1 Million attitude. Okay, now back to how to increase your believability with your prospects. Suggestion number 6, use testimonials. What better way to show how good your product is than having a customer tell a story? These could be letters, video messages, audio messages, or photographs of the customer using the product. Let me show you how it can work. Since you and I began sharing these ideas way back on message number 1, I've referred numerous times to the fact that I was no instant success. As a matter of fact, I was a failure in sales at first. And because selling is a learned skill, almost anyone can become very skilled in the science of selling with practice, dedication, and hard work. And my own career is proof of that. And you also might remember that my first sales manager, Mr. Vernon Cavill, was number 4 on my list of 5 most influential people in my life. Well, to show you how you can use testimonials in your selling, I'd like you to listen to Vernon Cavill describing what he remembers about our first encounter so many years ago. Vernon, it's all yours.
Joel, As I recall, I remember that a friend of yours introduced you to my business. He was working for me, and you came in, and we chatted for a couple of minutes, and you said, "I don't like salesmen." Wow, what an opening line for a guy looking for a job in selling. I thought I better sell him on what selling is. "Joel," I said, "did you know that George Washington was a salesman?" "Yes, the father of our country was a salesman." "And Joel, did you know that your good teachers, the ones who did a great job of teaching you to be what you are today, were salesmen or saleswomen? And Joel, did you know that all good priests and rabbis and ministers and religious leaders are salespeople? These people had a message, one they believed in, and they used salesmanship to sell what they believed in. Joel, I'll bet you never thought of your mother as a salesperson, but every day she sold you on developing into the person you have become." At this point, Joel said, "I want to do this. I want to become that kind of a salesman with your company." Well, I suggested part-time because that's the way most of my salespeople started. But Joel was pretty strong and said, "No, I want full-time. I'm going to resign my job and do this." Well, here he was, no sales experience, no money, a dislike for salespeople, a pregnant wife, and going to take a job on straight commission. It frightened me. He was convinced it was for him, and that frightened me. Well, he went through a training class and didn't make a single sale on his own for about 4 months, and making, I believe, over 1,200 cold calls. His only paycheck was for $48. Actually, Joel was good at showing the product, but not good at closing. I remember one day while working with him in the field, he built the need for the product. He showed the product very effectively, but he left his order form in the car when it was time to close. Fortunately, the prospect had a phone call, and it gave him time to run out to the car and get the order form. I told him to ask for the order. In fact, I told him what to say, and sure enough, she bought. Shortly thereafter, I suggested he quit. After I did that, I thought about the fact that he really needed a career, so I loaned him a record by Earl Nightingale. The title of the record was called The Strangest Secret. Well, Joel came back and he was really on fire. He was really unstoppable. After a short time, he became my number one salesman out of the more than 1,000 salespeople I had in my organization. And Joel remained the number one person until he and his family moved to Arizona. Joel proved that selling is a learned skill and that it takes focus, hard work, and persistence to make it work.
Thank you, Vernon. Now tell me, my listening friend, does that add a little more credibility to the story? I hope so. Plus, I wanted you to hear his approach to selling and what a salesperson really is. It's really a good reminder that selling is helping. So use testimonials in your selling. It could even be a recorded one like that. Who would you consider your first great sales trainer? The person who guided you, assisted you, and supported you with encouragement during those difficult beginning days of your sales career? How about giving them a phone call, writing them a thank you letter, or taking them out to dinner as an expression of your appreciation? It's so important to say thank you to those who have helped you in your career. And now the last suggestion, number 7, to achieve the highest degree of trust and believability. Do what you said you would do when you said you would do it. Show up on time. If you're not early, you're late. Return your phone calls. If you say, "I'll call you right back," that means right back. 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes max. Follow up on loose ends. Be attentive to detail. Don't let the little things get past you. And of course, do the little things that will earn you big results. The Sales and Marketing Managers Association once did an in-depth survey of purchasing agents. They asked these full-time buyers, perpetual prospects, how they felt about the salespeople that called on them. And they had the purchasing agents rank in order what qualities they most valued. They came up with 15 characteristics. I'll give you only the top five. Here, let me read them to you just as they stated them. 69.7% gave presentation and preparation a very high score, making it fifth. Number four was creativity in problem solving, an 80.5%. Number three, product knowledge, got a 90.7%. Number two, professionalism and integrity, came in at 93.7%. And number one, the most valued characteristic of salespeople was their reliability and credibility, coming in at an amazing 98.6%. Notice I didn't round off those percentages. It's much more credible being specific. And of course, those are the actual numbers. There's no doubt about it. Survey after survey confirms that the prospect, the customer, purchasing agent, decision maker, wants to buy from someone they can trust. So do what you said you'd do when you said you'd do it, and you'll thrive. And that almost completes this final message of Sell It with the Million Dollar Attitude series. So let's get to your final exam. Now, of course, there's no term paper, and no one but you will see the grade. Using a 1 low to 10 high rating system, how would you rate yourself on the 12 overall areas this program covered? Starting with message number 1 and ending with this one. If you can rate yourself a perfect 10 in each, that's a maximum score of 120 points. If you rate yourself a 6.5 average, that's 78 points. So a total score of 108 to 120 puts you in the top 1% club as a conscious, unconscious competent. That means in each of the 12 areas, you scored yourself either a 9 or a 10. Now, 90 to 107 points makes you an unconscious competent. And that's about a 7.5 to a 9 rating. And 78 to 89 puts you in the conscious competent group with a 6.5 to a 7.5 average score. So get your pencil or pen out, or just add it up in your head if you're driving in your car. Number one, thrilling your customer. How good are you at leaving such a positive impact on the customer that you serve? Number two, being a student of selling. How good are you at using your own buying experiences as a training vehicle for you to learn and grow? And how well are you using the 10 building blocks to the sale? Number three, the 10 to win concept. Using the list you created of the specific qualities you felt would make you the ultimate sales professional. How would you score yourself most of the time? Number four, identifying your prospects. That was the next area we covered. How good are you at knowing what qualities make up your best prospect and then finding them? Number five, qualifying. How good are you at using questions to find your prospect's needs and wants? Number six, selling the benefits and not the features. Are you building powerful units of conviction in the mind of your prospect and using evidence to prove those benefits? Number seven, how clear is the closing curve concept in your mind? Can you actually see where you are in your sales presentation? Number eight, are you piling on value and offsetting price with that added value? Number nine, asking for the sale. Are you closing without fear, without fumbling, and without fail? Number 10, responding to and cashing objections. How good are you at knowing what to say and how to say it when you're told no? How confident and skilled are you in responding to objections? 11. Providing service after the sale. Are you making service calls, generating referrals, and working your centers of influence? Number 12. Achieving believability. How much trust and belief do your prospects have in you? Well, there it is in a nutshell. The key points we covered. If you've reached level 3, a conscious competent, scoring 78 to 89 points, keep working to improve by focusing on those basics. If you're up to level 4, on unconscious competent at 90 to 107 points, you need to do just a little bit better in a few areas to hit that 108-point level and join the elite group of sales professionals who score 108 to 120 points and are card-carrying, bona fide, top 1% club members. Will I send you a certificate? Nope. You don't need a certificate, because like Willie, the people you serve will know by your actions. Each time you re-listen to this series, retake your score and watch how your numbers go up. Soon your income will increase and your level of fun will have you feeling, I can't believe they pay me to do this. This is just so much fun. And now, let me share with you some personal suggestions. As if you were a very close friend, just about to enter the profession of selling, and you came to me and said, Joel, based on what you've done, seen, and studied, what would you suggest I do to ensure that someday I'll be in that top 1% club? Well, here's what I'd suggest. 6 things for you. First, don't kid yourself. Be honest in your own self-evaluation of the effort you're putting forth and the results you're achieving. No one but you really knows how hard you're working, how committed you are. So as you look in that mirror, be straight with yourself. Next, set your own goals. The goals that your company or sales manager sets for you, they're really minimum requirements based on your territory, products, and market conditions. But don't stop at those limits. In most cases, you can do so much more. Third, commit to a regular and continuous program of self-improvement, daily physical exercise of some kind, listening while your eyes and hands are busy to messages like these, and listen repeatedly. You know, it takes 7 to 21 times for an idea to become a habit. Join a Toastmasters club, so you can train yourself to say the right thing at the right time. Call that 1-800 number, 1-800-9-WE-SPEAK, and find out where there's a club near you. And as part of your continuous self-improvement, keep accurate records. I know most salespeople dislike all those reports the company requires of them, but I suggest you keep even more records. Knowing your CPC, knowing your increase in performance is so important. Next suggestion, number 4, play the cards you were dealt. Stop wishing or hoping or attempting to become something you're not. It's not race, color, creed, sex, voice, height, hair. It's what you've got inside. Johnny Chan, poker player pro, said, I don't even need to know the cards I'm dealt. So win with what you've got by improving what you've got. Number 5, put your family and your faith above your work. When you're secure in those, your work will be much more effective. However, I'd suggest you put your work ahead of your hobbies, recreation, the community, and your friends. Once you're in that top 1% club, then you can start devoting more time to those other activities. And finally, suggestion number 6. As a good close friend I care so much for, I'd encourage you to laugh a lot. The power of humor is so awesome. In my other series, You Can Build a Better You, a whole message is devoted to positive humor. In the You Can Speak with Impact, another entire session is devoted to humor. In the You Can Lead Effectively series, an entire message is devoted to how leaders can make work fun. So laugh. Laugh so much your sides hurt. That's something you have control over. Read some funny books or the comics in your newspaper. Go to funny movies. Even silly movies. Watch funny shows on television. Humor puts a whole new spin on things. I hope these suggestions will be helpful to you as you progress in the wonderful world of selling. And now, one final story for you. Remember when you began listening to this program many hours ago, the first story you heard was about Willie Cooley, the cab driver. And if you remember, at the end of that story, after he picked me up for the second time and drove me back to the airport, I said to you, little did I know that our paths would cross again. And indeed, they did. Here's how it happened. That night of January 3rd, when I got back home from Memphis, I related the whole story of Willie Cooley to Judy, point by point, word for word. I had written it all down because it was so impacting. Well, she too was amazed by the story, and of course didn't doubt any of it. I mean, that's how we've stayed married since 1963. But I noticed that sometimes, when I was telling some of my associates and other acquaintances about Willie, I was met with a very different reaction. Like, come on, Joel, some of that might be true, but no cab driver could be that good, that professional. Why would they have their doubts, I wondered. I mean, Did the story just sound too good to be true? Could you have a sales story about your product that just sounds too good to be true, and therefore isn't believable? Well, fate must have meant the story of Willie to live on. Here's what happened next. Max Factor, the New York City-based cosmetics company, hired me to speak at their national sales meeting, to be held where? At the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. My assigned objectives were to cover what it takes to be a sales professional and to stress customer service. As I sat at my desk, stuff spread all around, I noticed a copy of my hotel bill from the Hyatt from January 2nd and 3rd, and an aha hit me. There was my theme, using the Willie factor. 6 words, 26 letters that can take your selling to the next level. Well, the meeting was scheduled for June. This was still January. So I had plenty of time to prepare and practice telling the story of Willie Cooley to almost anyone who would listen. And yet some people still seem skeptical. Well, as you know, problems are opportunities. So there had to be a way to increase my believability. Then I got my next aha. I still had Willie's business card, so I called him up and asked him if he'd be in town in mid-June. He said, well, yes, he would be. I said, okay, Willie, could I book you for an airport pickup, an airport return, and the full morning on my departure day? Oh, he said, I'm glad you're coming back. And what's the full morning for? A half-day tour of Graceland? Well, he started laughing, and so did I. No, Willie, what I'd like you to do is come to my meeting and just sit in the audience, and I'm going to tell the people the story of how we first met. And then when I'm done, I'd like to have you stand up so the attendees can see you and thank you for being a professional. Well, he said somewhat hesitantly, I guess my teeth should be in by then, and if my wife can come with me, I'll do it. So the months went by. I kept thinking about Willie and his story and how it had helped me so much, both personally and professionally, to be a better trainer, better speaker, and a better person. And I knew his presence in the room would give me so much more credibility. With Willie right there, my Memphis audience would surely believe. Then came another aha. If I had wanted to tell that story again, having a photo of Willie would probably add to my credibility. Even though I had a good camera, thanks to Brett, to make sure I got a really professional photo, I had the hotel recommend a local photographer that they used for weddings and other events at their hotel, and I hired him to meet us there on the day of the seminar. Well, are you excited to hear what happened? Are you? Well, can you imagine how excited I was? I mean, I couldn't wait till June. The day finally came. I arrived in Memphis, I got my bags, and sure enough, waiting outside the American Airlines pickup area, there was Willie Cooley, with top teeth, and his wife standing beside him. Well, it was like a family reunion. He hugged me this time. But true to form, he looked at my bags and said, Mr. Weldon, are these your bags? Then, like great top 1% club members do, he performed his task professionally, opened my door to his spotless interior, and we took off for the Hyatt. On the way, we discussed the next day's game plan. The three of us would meet the next morning in the meeting room at 7 a.m. to decide where they'd sit at the 8:30 a.m. start. We met that morning as planned, and then Mr. and Mrs. Cooley went to the hotel restaurant for breakfast, and I went back to preparing in the ballroom. About 30 minutes later, I'm still setting up in there, and Willie comes in, walks up to where I am, right up on the stage, and says, Mrs. Cooley and I talked it over, and I can't do this. I don't belong here in this fancy place with all these cosmetic sales and management people. I'm just a taxi driver. Could I just pick you up later today and drive you to the airport? And he started to hand me back the money I had paid him for his time that morning. Well, as you know, selling is really just good communication, and selling is helping too. So I had to sell Willie on the idea to stay. So using a cushion, I said, Willie, I understand how you feel. It's a big room, and lots of people you don't know. It could be uncomfortable for you. So what would you think of just sitting backstage behind this big curtain with Mrs. Cooley? And then only if I need you will I call you out. I promise you, nothing bad will happen to you, only good. Willie, you need to hear me tell your story. Your wife needs to hear me tell your story. And most of all, Mr. Willie James Cooley, this audience needs to hear your story. Well, a bit more relieved now, he says, okay, I'll do it, Mr. Weldon. I trust you. And I say, thank you, Willie. It'll be okay. So the meeting begins. Willie's backstage. I'm out in front of a few hundred sales pros and managers. And I share the story of Willie with them and related to their selling situation and their customers and their products. And then at the end I say, how did you like that story? And they clap politely. Now, I've been conducting seminars for years, and I knew when I had an audience and didn't have an audience. And this one, I didn't have. So I asked for a show of hands. How many don't really believe the story? And to my shock and dismay, almost every hand went up. Hey, they were a tough group, a skeptical and street-savvy group. So looking behind me, I quietly said, Willie, would you like to come out? They went dead silent. A hush came over the entire ballroom. The curtain moved, and out stepped Mr. Willie James Cooley, dressed in his cab-driving uniform, complete with name tag. The room erupted with thunderous applause, and they gave Willie a tremendous standing ovation. I looked at Willie, now standing right next to me, and he's crying. Then I started to cry. The audience sees Willie and me crying. They start to cry, crying and clapping for a wonderful example of professionalism and proof that jobs don't have futures, only people do. It's not what you do that's important. It's how you do it. So, my friend, think like a customer so that you can thrill your customers. Remember the Willie factor. Promise a lot. Deliver even more. And go out and sell it with the $1 million attitude.